From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
A small no-approach zone outside a reproductive health facility prevents harm to women before it happens and provides clear rules that actually promote free speech.
The proposed clinic access provision sweeps too broadly and would prohibit traditional First Amendment activities such as labor leafleting.
A discussion on buffer zones and free speech, not only at women's health clinics, but also in the form of a 9-foot wall around the IMF and World Bank meetings. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A senior Bush administration official said yesterday the United States had given Russia an unofficial deadline of November to agree to changes in the anti-ballistic missile treaty or face a unilateral U.S. withdrawal from the Arms Control Accord. It's the first time a member of the Bush administration has set a time limit for consultations that Bush pledged to undertake before developing a new national missile defense system. Such a system contravenes the 1972 treaty, which Russia has called the cornerstone of global strategic stability. American withdrawal from the treaty 6 months after a formal notification to Moscow would pave the way for the start of construction of a missile defense test site in Alaska. A Pentagon spokesperson announced yesterday that ground clearing for missile silos and a command center at Fort Greely, 100 miles southeast of Fairbanks, is to begin this week. The U.S. government came under fire yesterday over its stance during Rwanda's 1994 mass killings following the release of declassified official documents showing Washington anticipated events now seen as among the most gruesome atrocities of the late 20th century. Sally Booker, director of the Africa Policy Center, says the documents show the U.S. was aware of the scale of the killings, but adopted a course of inaction, in addition to preventing others from intervening in a way that could have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. The documents were released yesterday by the National Security Archive. The genocide was triggered by the apparent assassination of the Rwandan Hutu president. Shortly afterwards, a Pentagon official noted in a memo to the U.S. Undersecretary of Defense that, quote, unless both sides can be convinced to return to the peace process, a massive bloodbath will ensue that would likely spill over into Burundi. But just 3 days later, the State Department instructed the U.S. mission at the United Nations to work toward a withdrawal of the Rwanda-based UN force that many believe could have helped protect civilians. By the end of June, an estimated 800,000 people were killed by government-backed militias. The documents also show U.S. officials warned against calling the massacres genocide because Washington would then have to act. The U.S. is a signatory to anti-genocide conventions of 1948. A U.S. State Department spokesperson said yesterday the priority at the time had been protecting U.S. citizens. Prosecutors detained 16 members of a delegation of South Korean civic leaders who were suspected of violating South Korea's anti-communist law during a trip to North Korea. The group of 311 South Korean delegates returned home yesterday following a controversial trip to North Korea for a joint celebration of Korea's liberation from Japanese colonial rule in 1945. The South Korean delegation consisted of religious leaders, academics, dissidents, and civic representatives. On their return to South Korea, they were met at the airport by some 3,000 helmeted police. Earlier, scuffles erupted as police tried to take away white and blue flags that showed an undivided Korean peninsula from a group of activists who showed up to welcome the visitors. NATO's Supreme Commander gave the go-ahead for deploying troops to Macedonia yesterday, setting the stage for another NATO commitment in the volatile Balkans region. The NATO force will include a small U.S. component limited to logistics and intelligence. Unlike the open-ended peacekeeping mission in Kosovo, the NATO force in Macedonia will have a carefully circumscribed assignment, says the U.S. government. The troops have been ordered only to gather weapons from ethnic Albanian rebels who have risen up against the Slavic-dominated government in Skopje. The rebels agreed to disarm as part of a ceasefire signed August 12th by leading Macedonian ethnic Albanian political parties. The conservative-led Iranian judiciary sentenced a reformist member of parliament to 22 months in prison, finding her guilty of numerous charges, including, quote, propagating against the Islamic regime. The announcement comes as the reform-dominated Iranian parliament continued with a long debate on cabinet nominees proposed by President Mohammad Khatami. Kathy Boudin, the activist who participated in a 1981 Brinks truck robbery in which a guard and two police officers were killed, will go before a parole board today, but the relatives of the victims are campaigning to prevent her release from prison. Since Boudin pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was given a sentence of 20 years to life, she's become a model prisoner, according to officials at the facility. The Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in Westchester County is where she is incarcerated. She developed an AIDS education program that's been adopted by prisons nationwide. She's earned a master's degree in education and won a 1999 Penn Award for her poetry. If she is released on parole, her lawyer says, she will begin studying for a doctorate in higher education at Columbia University's Teacher College and will work with AIDS patients at a local hospital. But a group opposed to Boudin's release, Concerns of Brink's Survivors, has held a candlelight vigil and mounted a letter-writing campaign. As of yesterday afternoon, the campaign had produced 35,000 pieces of mail objecting to the possibility of parole. At today's hearing, parole commissioners will consider letters for and against her release, as well as a 450-page volume her attorney, Leonard Weinglass, has put together to describe her positive activities in prison. Among her letters of support is one from a prison chaplain who calls Boudin one of the 10 holiest people she has encountered. If the parole board approves Boudin's application, she may get out of prison as early as October. If it's denied, she could wait up to 2 years for a new hearing.
I opened a bank account when I was 9 years old. I closed it when I was 18. I gave them every penny that I'd saved, and they gave my blood and my urine a number. And now I'm sitting in this waiting room, playing with the toys. And I am here to exercise my freedom of choice. I passed their handheld signs, I went through their picket lines. They gathered when they saw me coming, they shouted when they saw me cross. I said, why don't you go home, just leave me alone. I'm just another woman lost. You are like fish in the water who don't know that they are wet. As far as I can tell, the world isn't perfect yet.
Lost Woman Song, Ani DiFranco here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Several weeks ago in Wichita, Kansas, the anti-abortion Summer of Mercy renewal campaign targeted one of the few clinics in the nation that perform late-term abortions. After marching on a Saturday morning, hundreds of abortion opponents knelt and prayed on the sidewalks across the street from the clinic operated by George Tiller, while abortion rights supporters gathered behind fences at the clinic entrance and across the street. Dr. Tiller's clinic was bombed in 1985, and Tiller was shot and wounded outside the clinic in 93, 2 years after the first Summer of Mercy march was staged in Wichita. But Operation Save America won a court fight with the city when a federal judge ruled that the city's denial of a parade permit violated the organization's First Amendment rights. Today, we're going to have a debate on one way that clinics have come up with to deal with protests and harassment outside. Yesterday, the New York City Council Public Safety Committee held hearings on legislation which would create a 10-foot buffer zone around people within 50 feet of a reproductive health clinic. Protesters would not be able to, quote, knowingly approach patients within 10 feet to pass them leaflets or engage in oral protest, education, or counseling with them without their consent. The New York legislation is modeled on a Colorado Supreme Court ruling from last year, which upheld a 100-foot buffer zone within health facilities and would prohibit unwanted approaches within 8 feet in that zone. The Supreme Court held that the Colorado law does not violate protesters' First Amendment rights. We're going to have a debate on this, and then we'll be joined by a lawyer in Washington, D.C., who has sued the government because of a 9-foot fence that is expected to be put up by the Washington, D.C. police to allow the World Bank and IMF meetings to go forward when the anti-globalization protesters come to town to Washington, D.C. at the end of September. But first, to this issue of buffer clinics around women's health clinics. We're joined by Jennifer Brown, who's director of the Reproductive Rights Unit in the Civil Rights Bureau of the Office of the New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. Arthur Eisenberg is with us, legal director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and Deborah Sweet from the Reproductive Freedom Task Force of Refuse and Resist. Jennifer Brown, can you lay out what you said before the New York City Council yesterday about why you support these buffer zones and what the legislation actually is?
What this legislation would do is establish a small area 50 feet around the entrances and exits of reproductive health facilities in the city of New York. And within that 50 feet, protest would be allowed. Picketers could hold signs, people could offer to talk with people coming by, could offer leaflets, but it would impose one restriction on persons within the 50-foot zone, which is that they could not approach closer than 10 feet to someone for the purpose of oral protest, education, or counseling, unless that person agreed to be spoken to. So that it would allow the full expression of views with that one restriction that they couldn't come closer than 10 feet to someone. Now, the Attorney General's office, I as their representative, testified in support of this bill for, I would say, three main reasons. One is this: the conduct that occurs outside reproductive health facilities, the mobbing of women, the screaming in faces, the very upfront, close, confrontational tactics often used by people opposed to abortion services, causes what one court after the next has deemed irreparable harm to women. It actually can increase the chances that the medical procedures they're going for will increase the risks of those procedures. So to establish a zone like this can actually prevent irreparable harm before it happens, instead of only giving an avenue for redress of that harm after it happens. That's one reason. A second is that while the Attorney General has brought lawsuits in two different federal courts in the state to argue that conduct of the type I just mentioned is a violation of the federal and New York State Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, that conduct makes it unreasonably difficult or hazardous to enter the clinic and therefore violates those laws. A lawsuit on that basis proceeds one defendant at a time, one incident at a time, one reproductive health facility at a time, and is an extremely time-consuming and intensive way of proceeding. And in addition, as I mentioned, the irreparable harm has already been done to women. So that's reason number two. And the third reason is that police officers testified at our hearing in Buffalo. The Supreme Court held, it's the U.S. Supreme Court that upheld the Colorado statute. The Supreme Court held that the establishment of bright line rules outside reproductive health facilities or other health facilities, such as this one, you can't come closer than 10 feet or 8 feet as in that case without agreement by the person you want to talk to, that those bright line rules actually promote objective enforcement of the law, and in that way promote the freedom of speech of people who are outside those facilities because they know what the rules are. Police are not called upon to make subjective decisions about whether harassment's occurring, etc. And so we feel that this type of bright line rule is very effective in both protecting the twin interests of access and of the First Amendment rights of people who want to oppose the services. This the Colorado 8-foot no approach zone was termed by the U.S. Supreme Court an exceedingly modest restriction on the persons outside those facilities, and we think that's an appropriate characterization.
So, Arthur Eisenberg of the New York Civil Liberties Union, what's your problem with it? You testified against the legislation in the New York City Council yesterday.
Let me just say at the outset that the New York Civil Liberties Union has long supported rights of reproductive choice for women, and we recognize that those rights are placed in jeopardy by acts of obstruction and violence and intimidation directed at those entering and leaving clinics. And we have supported in the past and continue to support various forms of clinic access legislation. It is this piece of legislation that we think goes too far. And it goes too far, we think, for two basic reasons. First, it conflicts with the traditional understanding of the First Amendment rights surrounding street encounters, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But second, it would sweep so broadly as to, for example, prohibit striking hospital workers from leafleting individuals entering and leaving hospitals to talk about their working conditions. It would prohibit health activists from leafleting in front of hospitals about a patient's bill of rights. So we think it sweeps too broadly. But returning to the first point, the traditional understanding about the First Amendment and street encounters had long held, at least prior to this, what I think is quite confused and confusing Supreme Court decision in the Colorado case. Prior to that case, traditional understandings held that one had a right to approach somebody, to ask that person to be engaged in some First Amendment discussion, some communication, to leaflet, to talk. But one did not have a right under the First Amendment to follow that person down the street and to continue to badger that person and to harangue that person after that person has declined the opportunity to engage in the discussion or the communication. That was the traditional understanding. We think that should be the understanding under the First Amendment. We think actually the Supreme Court decision suggests that that's the proper understanding, and that there's a sort of analytic disconnect within the opinion itself, because the opinion itself suggests that the interest that the Colorado statute was designed to protect was an interest in being free from being followed and harassed after one has declined an overture to engage in communication. And so we think that there are more appropriately narrowed legislative mechanisms that could deal with this problem, which wouldn't reach as far as this legislation
like what?
Does. Well, I think a prohibition, which sort of tracks the traditional understanding of the First Amendment, a prohibition against following an individual down the street and continually talking to them or trying to present them with leaflets after they have attempted to walk away or expressed a desire not to be engaged in communication is the appropriate limit and the appropriate way to go by way of legislation.
Well, Jennifer Brown, what's wrong with that?
I just think that the enforcement problems with that would be huge. I mean, who is going to be there to describe, to testify whether there was following or not? Was it following, or was it just that the person who was trying to talk to the individual happened to be walking in the same direction down the street? I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think that, and actually legislatures are free to choose the solution that they think best fits the problems that they've learned about. Our position is simply that this New York City proposal, like the statute upheld in Colorado, like a Massachusetts statute that was upheld by the First Circuit Court of Appeals just 2 weeks ago, that these are a legitimate way to deal with the problems that still occur outside reproductive health facilities.
I'd like to bring Deborah Sweet into the conversation, who is with the Reproductive Freedom Task Force of Refuse and Resist, volunteered as a clinic defender for 15 years, has visited more than 30 clinics in the country. With these buffer zones in place, who do the police go after the most, the anti-choice protesters outside or the people who come to defend those who are going into the clinic?
Well, I think we've had a variety of experiences around the country. In the situation in Wichita last month that you spoke about, the only people arrested there were over 100 over 1,000 anti-abortion protests and 100 and some pro-choice people were pro-choice activists who were picked out by the police under the same restrictions they were putting against the antis. The antis involved in an altercation with the pro-choice people were let go on the basis of the fact that they were only praying, that's P-R-A-Y-I-N-G, and the pro-choice people were using their buttocks as an assaultive weapon against the antis to keep them from getting closer to the clinic. That's one of the problems with law enforcement. But I wanted to speak directly about our experience extensively in escorting and being out in front of clinics in New York City with patients. What we have is a situation where there already is a clinic access law, and the New York Police Department is responsible for enforcing this law. The situation in Sunset Park in Brooklyn, a clinic where we escort avidly, it's a very wonderful clinic that really provides a service to the whole community and to women, is in the notorious 72nd Precinct of New York, where 2 weeks ago a lot of the officers were involved in a situation where 4 people were killed, including a pregnant woman.
You're talking about the...
We're talking about Officer Gray mowing down 4 people, happened to be 2 blocks from this clinic. So here's the array in front of a clinic. This is not nightly news, but this is what the drama that gets acted out every day in front of this clinic. There's a 20-foot display of gory fetus bloody posters that takes up more than half the sidewalk in front of the clinic. That's allowed under this legislation. There are 2 so-called counselors that approach every woman walking by the clinic, insistently, repeatedly, in their face. These people are part of a well-organized ideological army whose mission is to stop all abortion. Very clearly, they want to stop every single individual abortion, and legally and by other means, they are in solidarity with the people who want to harm doctors, bomb and close down clinics. Arrayed against this is the individual woman who shows up. In this case, 40% of the patients coming to this clinic are undocumented. More than 60% are on Medicaid. These are young women, women who don't necessarily speak English, who don't look at the police as their protector, that's for sure, and who are very intimidated by the presence of the Catholic Church, by rosaries being hung in their face, and by a priest who comes over and puts his arm around, "Dear, we'll help you. Don't kill your child. Mommy, don't kill that baby." This is the type of situation that an individual woman encounters, and the only thing we have found to really help that, despite the presence of the NYPD every hour in front of that clinic, is the staff and the pro-choice escorts who are out there to protect women and strengthen them.
And how often do they get arrested?
We're regularly admonished by the police to back off and allow the protesters to have their free speech rights. Meanwhile, the police never see the antis touching incidentally. They never see them ganging up 2 against 1 on patients, and we know this regularly happens when the escorts are not there.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Amara Verheyden-Hilliard, who's an attorney who has sued Washington, D.C. for the erecting of a large fence, I might call it a buffer zone, between the anti-globalization protesters and the World Bank and the IMF, and see how that fits into this story. We're talking to Deborah Sweet of Refuse and Resist, Arthur Eisenberg, New York Civil Liberties Union, Jennifer Brown with the New York State Attorney General's office. Stay with us.
And Lucille, your voice still sounds in me. Yeah, mine was a relatively easy tragedy. The profile of our country looks a little less hard-nosed, but you know that picket line persisted, and that clinic's since been closed. They keep pounding their fists on reality, hoping it will break. But you know, I don't think there's one of them that leads a life free of mistakes.